I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to the Friday Special, a podcast by Guitar Nerds. In this series, in each episode, I'll have a new guest from the world of guitars, amplification, effects pedals. We'll have brands and producers, musicians, and everything in between. I'm your host, Joe Branton, joined by our special guest, Mike Dawes, acoustic guitar extraordinaire, and the twice-heralded best acoustic guitarist in the world in a Total Guitar Reader's Poll. Hello, Mike, and welcome to the show.
Hey Joe, good to be here.
Ah, yes, it is. It's wonderful to have you on board. Now, dear listener, if you're not familiar with Mike Dawes, he's certainly not your conventional garden variety acoustic player. Mike is very much responsible for his own unique style of playing, incorporating, you know, tapping, double-handed tapping, percussive elements, all sorts of bananas. And I guess, in fact, his unique style and, you know, frankly, incredible ability has seen him tour all over the world with some of the biggest artists. He's hosted international guitar night events, taught on Sky TV's Guitar Style, and amassed millions of YouTube views for his various performances and lessons. There you go. Overview done. So, you know, to kickstart things, I guess, was it social media and YouTube in particular that, you know, that launched your career, or was it, you know, was it elsewhere?
Well, I'm sure everyone who's had any kind of quote-unquote viral video would love to think that it was all everything else, but actually, yes. When I was at university in the UK, I really got into this style of playing sort of steel string acoustic guitar. I grew up playing sort of metal and rock stuff in bands in sort of suburban Hampshire, but when I moved over to the West Country, I don't know what it was about the West Country, maybe the farms and the cider, but I switched to the acoustic and really fell in love with what you could do once you ditched the guitar pick and kind of, you know, looked at the instrument as just wood and wire and kind of looked at it a bit more with a sort of an experimental eye, I suppose. And during that time, I was touring a lot.
Interesting that it was electric guitar that you started with. I assumed, you know, as kind of with most acoustic players, that it's the thing that you start with and perfect. But it was the other way around for you?
Yeah, it was quite the opposite, actually. You know, I remember when I first decided I wanted to play guitar, it was actually because the cool kid at school had one. You know, it wasn't I was always into music. You know, I was playing, my parents had a keyboard and my dad played trumpet and I dabbled a bit, but it was, I moved around a lot to different schools as a kid. And once I settled in a place that was sort of, I felt like perhaps I didn't fit in. It was the new school, the secondary school. I thought, hey, the cool kid has an electric, so I'm gonna be that guy. And then we ended up starting a band, and then everything kind of went from there, you know. But no, the actual, going back to your previous question, the actual start of the career did come from one particular viral video of a song called "Somebody That I Used to Know" in 2012. It opened up a lot of doors. So I certainly, although I haven't been very active on YouTube recently. Actually, by the time this comes out, I'll have been getting back into YouTube because I have a lot of stuff planned and a new record. But that particular video really did kickstart everything, and I'm very grateful for that platform.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly something that, it's not just been that one video for you. It seems to be that you kept coming up with ideas that were incredibly incredibly successful on that platform. And I guess that's down to your very unique style. And I think maybe we should open a bit by talking about that, because you know, as I said in your introduction, it's such a different and interesting way of playing acoustic guitar, because you're so percussive with it, and there's so much more, you know, involved. And you know, I very much love acoustic guitar. I'm a big fan of parlor acoustics, and play finger style, but I'm very much a folk guitar player, and that's kind of the start and the end of my ability on the instrument. And you've kind of addressed acoustic in a totally different way, as kind of an all-in-one band instrument, as it were.
Well, firstly, that's really kind of you to say, man. I really appreciate that. I mean, the folk thing with acoustic was a big influence for me as well, because my mum in particular would always be listening to sort of folk stuff at home. And actually, my kind of introduction into the style was not through anyone playing with the whole percussion and the extended technique so much, but it was an amazing guitar player named Pierre Bensusan from France. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. I don't think I am. But he's just one of the best fingerstyle guitar players of all time in the world, still gigging, still touring, still making amazing records. And I guess that kind of school of playing, the more sort of traditional fingerstyle, combined with the background in sort of rock and metal music, kind of culminated in this kind of weird mishmash of styles, which, again, very influenced by players like Michael Hedges and Eric Roche, who's both players and no longer with us, unfortunately. But, you know, you mentioned in your introduction that I have a unique style, and as much as it's flattering to say, it would be silly not to acknowledge the people that certainly did experimental one-man acoustic guitar weirdness long before me, and that would be Michael Hedges and Eric Roche in particular as influences in my sort of progressive acoustic weirdo upbringing.
Yes, well, you know, I'm a massive fan of kind of anything that could be considered progressive, and of course, you know, you that's very much been a cornerstone. I feel like you've managed to cement loads of different genres into the things.
Shoehorn.
Yes, exactly. There's certainly some very proggy elements, and of course, you did the whole sort of moody blues last year,
I've been working with Justin Hayward, who's the frontman of the Moody Blues, sort of classic British prog rock band, you know, and I've sort of been his right hand man on guitar since 2013. It must have been, god, time flies, about as long as you've been doing this podcast, I'd imagine.
and
normally like once or twice a year we'll go out and do stuff, and the last tour that we did was last year. We had loads of stuff planned for this year, but of course, you know, things change. The great thing about that gig is that he's kind enough to let me open the shows as well, so it's a kind of dream gig where you get to sort of play your weird sort of written in your bedroom as an experiment to, you know, shut up a heckler at the pub music and then sort of run out to the front, sign a few CDs, run back, tie your hair up, and then play Nights in White Satin. So it's really a dream gig, and he is just the best. I mean, I hate to call him a boss, even though technically he is, but he is just the best boss in the world, really. Nicest guy, and such a fountain of knowledge. And talk about, you know, guitar nerdy gear stuff. I mean, they were the first band to use a Mellotron, you know, really, on a record, and then, you know, experimenting with stereo sound and all of that stuff. And his guitar archive on that tour is just outrageous. There's 19 different guitars on that tour. He plays like a different guitar in every song. It's quite amazing.
Yeah,
it is. And he was very, very kind, and he blessed me with a Tom Anderson Tele on the first day of the first tour, which I still play to this day. It's a fantastic guitar. So shout out to Tom Anderson for amazing guitars.
Well, you do. You have an absolutely fantastic sort of range of equipment. Like, what, you know, for as big a gear fanatic as I am, the amount of equipment that you have is very attractive to me and listeners of this podcast. Like, you,
well, we're all nerds, every one of us.
Yeah, exactly. And we could and definitely will go off on one about your equipment, but I kind of, you know, before I do that, I'd like to talk about your record that you've got coming out as well. Because that,
oh, well, that's very kind of you, Joe.
Well, we should of course talk about your music before, because I know the rabbit hole that I'm going to go down asking all about your incredible
absolutely
guitar.
Yeah, I've got a coffee next to me as well, because I am fully prepared to go deep. I'll go deep with you today, Joe.
Great, wonderful. What I want.
But yeah, the new record, it's actually out, I want to say next week ish, October the 30th. Yeah. And it's my third album. But the thing that makes this different is it's actually a live album. And the reason I was planning on releasing a sort of live EP or something this year anyway. But obviously things change in the world, and when COVID happened, I thought, well, hey, I really want to make this special. So I consulted, in part, the hard drive of... I'm always capturing things on the road, right? But rarely do I mix them unless it's for a specific project. So last year, I actually recorded two of my opening sets that I did with Justin from the Moody Blues, right? So the Justin Hayward solo show. We did a show in New York and a show in Florida, and both of which he was recording for a sort of... a DVD or PBS special or something like that. And I was very fortunate that I managed to convince the audio guys and the video guys to just hit record on my set as well. And I am so lucky that I'm satisfied with the playing. In fact, not just satisfied, I'm proud of the playing on those takes, because I'm my own worst critic. You know, we all know as guitarists, especially guys who tour, nothing's ever good enough. But there was something about these two shows that everything just went right. And I was so glad those were captured. So I went back to the UK and we started mixing those. And then when COVID happened, I actually decided to extend it a little bit and make it a full album. So we actually have included two songs from my very first headline show in the US ever at the Iridium, Les Paul's place, the famous Iridium on Times Square. And a few other, another track from that first tour. But then there's also a duet of the song One by Metallica with an amazing guitar player called Quist. I don't know if you know Quist or have had him on the show, but he's an amazing player. He used to play for Brian Ferry from Roxy Music, I think. Roxy
amazing.
We tracked that at a studio. It's actually sort of live in the studio. And anyway, the album is called Shows and Distancing. Shows and Distancing, live in the USA. And I mean, basically, the reason that it is all done in the USA is because that country is the reason I have a career, essentially. Every time we tour with Justin, or more or less every time, it's over there. All the international guitar night shows, tours, which are, you know, big, you know, packed theater shows, are over there. It's my management's over there. I mean, my life is over there. Any life of mine that isn't in Bristol in the UK, where I am now, is in the States, and I miss it so much. It's obviously going through a turbulent time right now, with just everything going on in the world, including the lack of live music. So coming out next week, Shows and Distancing, live in the USA, it's just my sort of love letter and gratitude to the people over there and the live music fans all the world that are just needing their live music fix, you know.
That's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, thanks. And I must mention actually that a couple of days after, on the 1st of November, I'm going to do a live stream show as well from my home here in Bristol. So I was going to say, if there's any tickets left, you could pick one up, but it's digital. I guess there's unlimited tickets, right? Is that how it works? I don't think there's a cap.
No, well, exactly. There you go. You could be
exciting.
Playing to, you know, the largest arena in the world.
Or like 10 people, you know, who knows?
One of the two. But yeah, we'll put links in the description of this podcast, dear listeners.
Thanks, Joe. You're lovely.
Check that out. Ah, there you go. but you actually, you know, it feels like you've really taken advantage of lockdown, because of course, you know, not only obviously you have Shows and Distancing, the record, you know, taking advantage of lockdown, but that you know, it's certainly been influenced by that. You also did your lockdown lessons, because you're you're very active in the educational side of musicianship as well, because you've got your own like original compositions taught at grade 8 in the Trinity College of Music.
You've gone deep, Joe. You're a great man. I like this man. What a great voice he has. Mm. A voice for podcasting and radio professionals everywhere.
It's not a face for a face for radio. That's what it is.
So I used to be a guitar teacher sort of by trade, and I've made a bunch of apps for guitar. You know, they're all in the app store teaching this style, actually. So there's one called, I think it's Percussive Acoustic Guitar with Mike Dawes or something. And and lots of things like that. And but what happened is when I started having some success with my own sort of creative output and getting fans through YouTube and things like that and started touring, I started teaching them on Skype, sort of in between tours, because I just love teaching. But unfortunately, what happened is I realized that the internet connections at Holiday Inns and that are not so reliable, and, you know, scheduling lessons. Okay, well, tomorrow I'm crossing into this side of Tennessee, so that's a different time zone. So, you know, it just became so complicated.
Yeah.
So I opened up a few lessons just for Patreon people. But yeah, I mean, I was able to now, obviously not being on tour, open up more slots. So every Sunday, I think I have like two or three slots, like just little half an hour slots. And it's great. I've had everyone from people just wanting to know about gear and or people just wanting to learn some of my tunes or even hardcore guitar technique nerds. But it's been nice to get back into that for sure. It's nice to have free time. But man, do I miss the road much. That's why this record's so cathartic. It's just like, I mean, I don't once it's out, I'm not going to be able to, you know, once it's been mastered, which it has at this point. I'm not going to be able to listen to it. It's going to be too much. You know what I mean? It's really, touring's been such a big part of my life for the past sort of 7 or 8 years. 11 months of the year was spent on the road.
Wow,
didn't really live anywhere. It was just suitcases and hotels and buses and stuff like that. So
I mean, that sounds like the absolute dream. But yes, you know, to be in that position and now, of course, completely cut short. You know, you've also done loads of articles and things regarding tuition as well. It's not only the lessons you do, but you've written for guitar magazines, I think.
Yeah, I did that as well, and I still do that a bit. Unfortunately, print magazines are having a bit of a hard time just because it's 2020. Well, not just 2020 implying anything COVID related, just because it's a digital world, you know. And I wrote for many years for Acoustic Magazine, but unfortunately that's no longer with us. So instead, I've done a lot of video columns and things like that. So I'd go out to Manhattan and do some stuff for the Guitar World guys. Coincidentally, the digital editor of Guitar World lives here in Bristol. So I think we're going to go see that movie Tenet at some point, that new Chris Nolan movie, which is, by the time this comes out, will have probably been released hopefully not critically panned. no spoilers, please. It's nice to keep busy. But to be very honest, this transition into the COVID life has been absolutely, it's like the upside down on Stranger Things, you know?
I have no
doubt. It's completely different. It's a very unusual and odd situation, but we're all in it together, that's for sure.
On a lot of these Friday specials, I talk to brands, you know, more than anything else, luthiers and things like that. And certainly when it comes to luthiers or pedal makers, and you know, over the last 5-6 months since we've been in this COVID situation, they're all loving the amount of extra sales that they've had. And it's been kind of like a conversation of, well, yes, everything is terrible, but it's wonderful that we're selling more things. And
right.
So it's, you know, you're one of the first people we've spoken to that's obviously really been hit by it. And that, you know, that it's terrible that this has prevented you from touring. It's wonderful that you're taking advantage of it as much as you are with the lessons and with the record. I'm glad that you're sort of turning that into a positive as much as it can be.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got to, but you know, it was very, very tough, and it still is, you know, because there's artists that tour, but then there's artists that live out of a suitcase, and I was certainly one of the ones that lived out of the suitcase.
Yeah,
and one of the things that made it extra unusual is that by sheer coincidence I committed to buying my first house just as this started. So I signed the contract, I think in a Best Western hotel lobby in like Idaho in February, right? And the move-in day was scheduled for the 23rd of March,
right?
So obviously when I came back, you know, and various decisions around that house, such as, okay, well, the furniture's going to come from here, and guess what? It doesn't matter. I'm going away on this tour, so I won't get that because I've got this coming in and all that stuff. So, yeah, that was a bit strange and a bit of a traumatic kind of, I've just sunk everything into a house and now there's no work. What am I going to do? But,
you've stayed in Bristol for that as well.
I have, yes. Well,
wonderful.
So I was born in Bristol, but never really lived here. I grew up in Hampshire. But since touring started, I was generally kind of the musician who kind of crashed with his girlfriend when he came home kind of thing. Nice. You know, the butt of every kind of drummer joke. That was me. But yeah, so it has been a huge thing. I'm perfectly happy to be candid about it, because I think it's important for people to understand. I know your listeners understand, but things like how the general mainstream public, the media, the government, things like that tend to, or it feels like they tend to forget about the people that slip through the cracks. And certainly the self-employed touring community, I really feel for them all. And other musicians that I've spoken to are in the same situation. You know, overnight we lose 85% of our annual income, and then we have to build a business from scratch from that, you know.
Absolutely.
It's crazy. But all the love to everyone who's thriving. It's not like we're bitter. I mean, the music community, everyone's in it together, and everyone wants everyone to succeed. So please support your luthiers, and your, you know, buy your gear and subscribe to your things. And, you know, we're all creatives, and we have the internet, and we have these amazing tools at our fingertips, and we have Toman and we have Andertons and all this stuff, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the best time in history to have a pandemic, I'll tell you that, if you're a nerd or anyone, you know.
There you go. That's very true. Yeah. But you know, actually, you know, on that note, I'm very much at the moment a big fan of British gear, and I'm trying to put together sort of more podcasts and series and get more guests from the you know, British luthiers, British amp makers, pedal builders, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a scene that often sits in the shadow of all the absolutely incredible stuff coming out of the States. But Bristol is actually a fantastic city for that sort of thing. I mean, a city very close to my heart, where all the guitarists are from Brighton, which is, of course, the other version of Bristol.
It is. I mean, if you're listening to this from overseas and you're thinking of coming and spending time in a city in the UK, go to the ones that begin with B. You know, you've got Bristol, you've got Brighton, and you've got Bath as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Ignore London. Just no offense, London guys. No offense. It's fine. It's just smoky, bad air.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, Bristol, absolutely fantastic city. It's home, of course, of my favourite festival in the world, ArcTangent.
Oh, so good.
Has some incredible bands that have come out of there. I've had some of my favourite gigging experiences in that town. Have some of my best friends there, and of course, you have some incredible luthiers that have come out of Bristol.
Well, you got Mr. Waghorn.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, Mr. Waghorn, and actually my ex is a understudy, sort of apprentice. You got Waghorn. There's a couple of sort of super techie nerd fixers around, you know, proper sort of men in sheds that I love taking my acoustic to when I need a little tweak, and it's great. We've obviously got, it's the home of Massive Attack and Banksy and Blackbeard the Pirate. Wallace and Gromit, I think.
Oh, really?
I think Aardman is Bristol. One. Yeah.
There you go.
I could go deeper, course, but the international listeners will switch off. So.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, you know, Waghorn responsible for the Alex Hutchings signature.
Well, Alex is here. Yeah, Alex is down the street. Amazing guitar player. Great guy. Yeah. We met in Norway, actually, at a... I met him at the same time as our mutual friend Matt Knight.
Matt Knight,
From Boss, because I flew over to do this festival in Larvik. It's called the Larvik Guitar Festival. Fantastic. They had Paul Gilbert there, Marty Friedman. For some reason, they booked me as well. I don't know why, but the airline lost my guitar and all my gear.
No.
Yeah. So fortunately, it was a spa hotel, so I was walking around in a dressing gown with, you know, Rabir and all of that crew. In order to do my little set, Matt and Alex kind of sorted me out with a load of Boss gear to kind of wing it with.
Wow.
And then Alex came up and joined me for a little jam during my workshop. So respect and shout out to Alex Hutchings and all the guys at Boss. Not just amazing gear, amazing guys. And obviously Alex, absolutely world-class guitar player as well.
An absolutely world-class guitar player. I remember when I was with him at ArcTangent. I think it was in 2018, and Tosin Abasi came up to him and was like, "Oh, I really love your stuff."
Yeah, yeah.
And Alex was, you know, for the rest of the day, retelling that story every 10 minutes or so.
The guy from the Bill and Ted soundtrack loves my stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But yes, let's segue now into equipment, because you have an incredible guitar, an incredible legacy of guitars, both acoustic and electric, and a really interesting use of effects and I guess sounds in many sense, and pickups as well. There's so much to cover.
There's a lot to unpack.
I mean, I'm also, you know, we try and have a sort of a clean rating on this podcast, but we're absolutely not going to be able to when we introduce your the name of the brand of guitar that you use.
Yeah, well, I some publications won't print it, but
really, wow.
As of now, so here's the thing: it's an international world, right? Yeah. We understand other languages exist, and words mean different things in other languages. For example, Richie Kotzen, I believe Kotzen in German means vomit, or something like that.
I see.
Right.
Okay.
Now, my guitar maker, or one of my guitar makers, I've been playing his guitar for about 3 or 4 years now, and his name's Andreas Kunz. Unfortunately, Kunz is spelt with a C. That would be C, U, N, and then a T and a Z. And it came sort of embedded into this massive guitar case as I took it through the airports in America, swiftly got told off by the TSA, and now I use a mono gig bag. But amazing guitars from Germany in a little town just outside of Frankfurt. And I also play acoustic guitars from a great luthier down near your way, Lewis.
Yeah.
Which is just next to Brighton.
Lovely little town.
Yeah, he's called Nick Benjamin, and he's I've got three of his guitars, and he's
amazing.
Nick
Benjamin makes absolutely incredible stuff.
Incredible.
And I understand your Kunz, because you have your own signature model with Kunz.
Well,
guitars.
Yeah, it's a signature model, but it's a guy in a shed making it. So if he wants to stick my name on it, cool, that's it. You know, you won't find it in stores. You'll find it on Tom Ann, but you know, unfortunately, like US stores, for example, won't retail his guitars because of the name.
Right. That's a great shame, because it's an incredible
guitar. Yeah.
I find the pinstripe binding on it for me is absolutely gorgeous.
Quilted maple, yeah, back and sides. I mean, it's lush. Actually, we have another one on the go, so we're working on a little project. So maybe by the time this airs, I'll have it in my hands. We'll see.
Oh, that's interesting.
But yeah, amazing guitars, and I always support the men in sheds, because you know, and now. I will say that bigger guitar brands are now starting. I'm seeing bigger brands starting to take the fingerstyle needs and requirements very seriously. So it will be interesting to see where this goes in a few years' time. But for now, the men in sheds are the guys that get it. And I have very specific requirements in terms of string spacing, and pickups that I'm sure we'll get into.
They'll do it for you.
Yeah,
your signature model is so specific. I love that it's a real signature model in the...
Oh yeah. There's no compromise. There's zero compromise.
Yeah. You've not lent on anything from before. I mean, except maybe the neck profiling, which I think you have your neck profiled the same as a specific Taylor that you used to play.
Yeah, yeah. My very first acoustic guitar, I figured I like this neck, let's keep it. I measured it exactly. And that's what now obviously it's changed a little bit. It was actually Nick Benjamin that changed it a little tiny bit. And then the Kunz was based on the Benjamin. So it's a little bit of sort of, you know, whispers, you know, like going through the process. But I consider it to be, you know, I can pick up any of my acoustic guitars. And if it was a blind test, you know, other than the feel of the lacquer, there wouldn't really be much to give it away. So
no,
I like
great.
That. About, I like the consistency.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the consignature on all the various things that you have going on there, because it's also part of it is a bit of a collaboration with Benjamin Guitars, right? In the percussive nature of it, you're sort of a scratch patch.
Yeah. So the we are going deep, Joe. We are going deep.
Yeah, there you go.
So okay. So the story goes that. I one of the players that got me into this style, as mentioned earlier, was a great player named Eric Roche. Now he passed away sadly many years ago, but he used to teach at the ACM in Guildford, which one of his students there was a man named Newton Faulkner, who any guitar player from the UK will know as being a big mega pop star in the UK. Great guy, amazing guitar player, and the first guy, I would say arguably anywhere in the world, to bring modern percussive fingerstyle guitar into the mainstream.
He popularized the top of the
charts. Yeah, absolutely. And in Europe and in the UK and Australia, he's like a household name, right? An amazing guy. And I will say an underrated guitar player. Because, you know, he's making songs, there's songcraft and production in there. But you hang out with him and you see him play, man, that guy is the real, real deal. Shout out to him if he's listening. But Nick made his guitars. Nick made the guitars for him. His name's Sam, so Sam Newton Falconer or something. So Nick made guitars for Sam and for Eric. And that whole British connection of doing open mic nights led me to, hey, you sound like Eric Roche. You sound like Newton Falconer. You should check out these guitars.
I see. Right.
And Nick had developed this way of covering up damage to the top.
Because, of course, the percussive nature of it must cause...
Exactly.
Now, damage over time.
I am a feeble weed of a man, Joe, and I don't really damage guitars because I hit very lightly and like to let the pickups do the work. However, some players hit hard, right? Mm. Think of Willie Nelson. Think of Trigger, right? Now, that there's holes and all kinds of damage to this kind of stuff. Now, Nick created a little method of just sticking a little bit of spruce over the top of a hole in, I believe it was Eric's guitar. Eric Roche's guitar. And instead of letting that be, Eric would just mess with that instead and scratch it up. And what ended up happening is the soft parts of the wood got worn away, but the hard grain stayed, and it created sort of like a guiro kind of sound, right? And that ended up becoming part of the sort of percussive guitar player's sort of arsenal. And because Nick was making me a guitar at that time, I thought, well, let's stick one of those on there and see what I can do with it. And then ever since, because so many of my core compositions and arrangements have involved this, I have to have it on every guitar, otherwise I can't do the show, right? Right. So Nick, well, I call it a scratch pad because it's a pad that you scratch, but Nick likes to call it a scratch patch, but I think that sounds like some kind of like anti-eczema, anti-inflammatory medicinal aid.
Yeah, something you get a dog when it's got fleas.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Stop it. Yeah, so the little scratch pad.
Introducing scratch pad.
Yeah, but you know what? To go deep on the gear, other guitar companies and other guitar players have started to put these things on their guitar to play some of these tunes from people like myself, like Thomas Lieb, Newton Faulkner, and others. However, they will use any old wood. Now, the reason that doesn't always work is because it's about the grain. Like the sound you get when you scratch it has to...
I understand. You
know what I mean?
That so texture.
With walnut, it doesn't really work. So, yes.
So it's the texture, but it's not just that. It's the grain spacing becomes
exactly
important.
Exactly. All of that matters. So this is how deep we're going. We're going into the grain of a wood.
Specifically the spacing of that grain.
Yeah, the spacing between the grain. Exactly. So, for example, one thing that does work, if you're interested in trying it, is, you know, I did a workshop in the Austrian Alps with Thomas Lieb. It was Thomas Lieb's kind of guitar boot camp. I've done a few of them. And because it's in a ski chalet in Austria, there's plenty of beer mats around. So all the students were picking up the beer mats and just taping them to their guitar. And just by flicking on the rigid surface of a beer mat, you can get a passable sound to use in a workshop, you know. But to do it properly, yeah, spruce spruce and double-sided tape, that's all you need. I get so many emails. Like what, I used to be sort of every day, but, you know, once every couple of days, hey, where can I get that wood for your guitar? It's from a tree, mate. Just go outside and get some spruce and stick it on the guitar. There's not much else to it.
And I've seen players with more pads than you use, but you just have the one fitted to the underside,
sort
of nearer the board.
So there's a limit to how I like to operate creatively, and part of that is restraint. So the way I suppose I could explain it, looking at my phone right now, is that I'm terrible with Photoshop, right? But I'm really quite creative with graphic design in an app. And the reason for that is the app is limiting and it forces you to think, okay, well, how can I achieve what I want to achieve with the limited tools I have?
Understand.
And that brings me so much joy and sense of accomplishment. So the only thing that makes anything that I do on the guitar different to anything that anyone could do on any guitar off the shelf is just the little pad of wood. But that's not even necessary. That's only there to protect the top because I don't want it to get scratched up. You know what I mean? It's you could just scratch up the guitar. That's fine. It's not gonna break the thing. It's just gonna make it a little rough in a place. So there's all these extra extensions which all these guitar companies are coming out and small men in sheds making these little accessories for guitar. And some of them I've played with. Some of them I like. Some of them I don't. But it's all down to the individual creative task. Right now, I'm pretty happy in still exploring the core guitar and trying to still squeeze as much creative juice out of that as possible. However, my next album that I'm writing in lockdown inevitably will have to expand upon that at some point. I have a few ideas that will involve a bit of drilling and a bit of this and a bit of that. But the core show and the core message is that, you know, what I'm trying to do is just expand the possibilities of an acoustic guitar. And the moment it becomes something with a bicycle horn attached to the headstock and you've got cymbals on your back and a bass drum, you know, that then becomes a bit too much of a circus, but not for any elitist reason, just because it's expanding the parameters and it makes it harder for me to be creative with limitless parameters. I hope I'm making sense.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's just personal preference. There we go, summed up. It's personal preference.
Well, speaking of personal preference, you've also gone for quite an unusual nut width because you've gone very narrow on the...
This is the best podcast I've ever done.
Well, there you go, yeah.
Nut width.
Stuff, but nut width I thought was really interesting because I guess, you know, it's certainly for like fingerstyle playing, you'd be looking at something maybe like 45, 46, yeah. Like you sort of would be a narrow nut width, but you've gone for, I can't remember if it was 43 or 44.
Super narrow. It's both.
Really
so,
narrow.
Yeah, so the Benjamins are 43. And I asked Andreas Kunz to do 43, and he was like, no, this is stupid. We do 44. So I was like, all right, man, that's fine. So that's the one difference there. But I can't tell it. I can't tell the difference really in my fingers. Sure. Everything else about the neck feels identical. But the reason for that is twofold. First of all, I have quite long, slender fingers, so I managed to be quite accurate, and I'm okay not kind of spilling over and muting another string. I think I've got a bit of an advantage because I don't have kind of stumpy sausage fingers. Also, it goes back to the first guitar and just having small hands and being a kid and handing it to people and saying, play this acoustic guitar because I bet you will be able to play it better than you think. For example, on the tour bus of one of the tours with Justin a few years ago, Misha from Periphery came onto the bus and played my guitar and was instantly just like, yeah, this is the easiest acoustic guitar I've ever played, right? Because it's the electric guitar player's acoustic guitar. What I mean? If you're coming from playing a Les Paul, you're going to be able to play this guitar no problem. Because the number one complaint that I hear is, you know, from electric guitar players is the acoustic guitar is the hard one to play. You know what I mean? It's like it's harder to play. It requires you've got to squeeze more. You know, you.
That's definitely yeah. But then
lower your action. You know what I mean? It's like I understand why acoustic guitars off the rack have a reasonably high action because most guitar players want to just strum Wonderwall or whatever, right? And that requires an action of a certain height to eliminate buzz. But I play very delicately and with individual fingers, individual notes, and I'm only really limited to the strength of my nails because if I play too hard, my nail's going to break. So I can get away with a lower action and still not have any buzz. So you can be very accurate and it's just so easy to play. And then, of course, that opens up the door to the extended techniques like extreme sort of tapping licks on the acoustic. You can't really do that if the action's too high. I mean, not just for the strength, but just the horrible harmonics that you get as well.
Of course, yeah, you know? Absolutely.
So there's a few reasons why the action's very low, but I have a truss rod with me, and in the US especially, when you're on tour there, whether or not if you're in a bus, then the guitar might be in the trailer, and you're going through the Arizona desert, and then you end up in like humid Seattle or in Montana in the winter. I did a tour, the one tour I did this year, started in Alaska in January. and it was minus 39 degrees in Fairbanks.
I bet you needed that Allen key.
The Allen key, absolutely. But, dude, our nose hairs froze as we left the airport. You step outside and you're thinking, what's going on? And your
sounds
nose
awful.
Hair's frozen. Just outrageous. But, so bring a truss rod and know how to use it. That's something that, the listeners are clearly guitar nerds, but if you don't know how to... adjust your action, it's something you should really learn before you start going on tour and things.
Well, with an acoustic, it's
huge.
Not really just the action, because you don't have an adjustable bridge. You've got to look at, yeah. I assume you have a very sanded saddle piece.
Yeah. I have multiple saddles.
Right.
So I have a bunch of different saddles, and sometimes if the truss rod adjustment isn't going to cut it, then I'll swap out a saddle. I'm only comfortable doing that because my piezo is not an undersaddle transducer. Because then you're just, if you remove the saddle, you're exposing the pickup, and maybe there's a bit of dust, or maybe you put the other saddle in and it doesn't go flat and there's a bit of air and it changes the tone a bit. So my piezo is stuck under the bridge plate in the inside. So
which I think is much better.
It's
anyway.
Just a better tone. It's just a much better tone.
I completely agree. There's so much... There's such a sort of a nasal, I don't know how to describe it, like a really aggressive tone that's hard to shape from the under saddle piezo.
Yeah, I've always associated it with the sound of a guitar, which is just in your local guitar store and you plug in and no one really cares about the pickups. It's got that quack, that brightness and that sort of naily kind of click to it that sounds a bit thin. The bridge plate style of piezo unit just gets rid of all that horrible harshness on the top. And not only that, but I find it really it's actually more isolated in terms of mixing a multi pickup system. Because
let's talk about that.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Because you've got four pickups. But sorry, finish your point first.
Well, no, I mean, it's a segue into what you were just about to say. I mean, you mentioned I have multiple pickups, and with that comes the problem of EQing the different pickups and blending them. And obviously, if you've got a piezo that's under the saddle, you're going to be picking up a lot more of the top of the guitar than a bridge plate pickup. I mean, it's not a huge difference, but in even the different brands of pickups I've tried, it makes enough of a difference to make it much easier to mix on stage, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
So four pickups in your guitar, which obviously is there because there are various tones you need to isolate from the percussive nature to the playing. But also, I imagine because you know you're in order to achieve the things that you do, you have to be quite a light touch, and so you require the guitar to do more of the amplifying for you rather than your hands.
I guess going back to what I said, anything that you hear live which involves pickups, you can do unplugged, right? The goal of the pickups is to just represent what you're doing live, but to more ears.
Sure.
In an instance. So you're trying to keep it as sort of natural as possible. But at the same time, there are some benefits to some of these pickups which can amplify your show. So, for example, the main source of the sound is a mix between the piezo, which I consider to be the sort of acoustic guitar sound,
right,
and a magnetic sound hall pickup, which I actually developed with Damasio pickups. It's called the Black Angel, which sounds like a sort of, you know, D-list DC superhero. But
because of course they had the Angel, right? Yeah. was a normal Damasio pickup that you could get for a long time. So the Black Angel was something you worked with them on.
Yes, and actually it was a collaboration with Nick Benjamin, the aforementioned luthier, as well. And what we changed about it is, first of all, we made it passive. Second of all, we made it black. And third of all, and most importantly, we added a phase switch to the pickup. And anyone, as I'm sure the people listening will know, once you start looking at multiple sort of audio sources, in this case, different pickups, having control over the phase is incredibly important.
Well, of course, yeah. And you're just depending on where you are and what room you're in, you're going to lose all your low end, you know.
We hear it as just the low end dropping out, right? So when I'm on stage at every sound check, even, or if I do any messing around with the guitar or whatever, I'll sound check and I'll just flick the phase switch, and you hear either an overwhelming amount of bass, either a bass loss, or everything's just right, and you just got to find that balance, you know.
Yeah.
But the main sound comes from there. The peripheral sounds come from an internal microphone. I'm drinking coffee at the same time, and I might have hiccups, so we'll see how that goes. An internal microphone, which helps pick up the aforementioned scratch patch and the sides and the top of the guitar when you're doing the percussive stuff. But that's at a very low level because it's a mic in a box. It's always going to sound like a mic in a box. You want as little as you can get away with, right?
Well, it's very much going to be doing the job of, you know, a mic'd... I'm trying to think of the name of a drum.
Well, you know, it's like it almost sounds like the overheads, just because it's all it can be very harsh, and I actually have a low cut on it because that's where the feedback comes from, you know.
Yeah.
So the mic doesn't need low end because it's just picking up all of these kind of like side knocks and things like that. The real heavy meaty percussive stuff comes from a cross between the piezo and the fourth pickup, which is, well, I call it the kick drum pickup. It's just a little contact transducer that is on the soundboard underneath where, if you think about the picking position of an acoustic guitar, and then you look at your picking hand, and then imagine you're on a motorbike and you rev that motorbike, the heel of your hand moves down and will connect with the top of the guitar, and right underneath there, or just off to one side, because I try to avoid direct contact, is a contact transducer with a lot of low end and you know, it's compressed and whatever. And that, when you're playing through a big system, that goes out to the subs and just makes it a rock show for sure.
That is such a complex pickup setup for a guitar. Like, what led you to make those decisions?
Well, first of all, I started... first of all, the kick drum pickup is only necessary on my Kuntz guitar. The reason for that is we have a slightly reinforced top, so I wasn't getting enough thump out of just the piezo. On the Benjamins, I get enough thump out of the piezo channel anyway, so a three pickup system is what you can get away with.
Right.
That being said, when you do have that pickup, you can do some interesting routing and interesting extra stuff, you know, like you could sidechain your whole rig to the kick. Right, so you could be playing electronic music, and every time you hit that kick, then
it sucks everything out.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah. So, but what led me to it? First of all, it was piezo and mic. That's how I started. That's what Andy McKee was doing at the time. That's what everyone was doing at the time. But then I started playing with the magnetic pickup because I was interested in effects like distortions and octaves, and you know, the OC3 by Boss I've had on my rig forever. The OC3 super octave pedal has a polyphonic range filter on which frequencies it applies the octave to. So I can set it to just apply the frequencies of the low octave to the bottom string, more or less.
I find that feature so useful.
How is it that there's no other pedals like that?
It's so strange. The OC3 gets very underrated in the octave pedal market.
Completely underrated. If you're doing anything with polyphonic music, like fingerstyle guitar or anything, get the OC3. Like,
well, yeah, absolutely. And it is exactly that. You know, I see people coming up with pickups that, you know, just apply to your E and your A string, or, you know, your two lower strings, and, you know, things like that to allow you to have a bass.
Yeah.
When you're playing guitar, it's like, well, the OC3 does it.
The OC3
pick them up secondhand for about 50 quid.
Like, exactly. You know, so, and actually, some of my pedals are real cheapo bits of gear. Not that the OC3 is a cheapo bit of gear, but I do have some real cheapo bits of gear. it does it. The difference between having separate pickups, because I do have another guitar, like a little special build that Nick built me, where I do have separate piezo pickups on the bottom two strings, but that allows me to do things like add a synthesizer to it. You know what I mean? Other stuff. The OC3 is great. It's a stomp box on a pedal board. And when I record all my albums, I record the wet octave as well. And then we can mix that into certain sections that need a bit more oomph, right?
Very good.
But what I'm saying is that's only receiving sound from the magnetic sound hole pickup because it's only hearing the strings. Right. If I were to send the microphone line down that to that octave, it will just be horrible. And the piezo, yeah, every time you do a kick drum sound or hit the top of the guitar, mm-hmm, that's going to be generating an octave tone. So, you know, but by having a magnetic sound hole pickup, you're basically adding an electric guitar rig to your acoustic guitar rig. So there's distortions and other stuff. The distortion's actually an amp simulator pedal because, you know, running a distortion straight into the PA sounds like garbage. So I've got the Joyo American Sound amp sim, which again, like 20 quid or whatever. And no one buys it because they have amps. But guess what? I don't.
Joyo pedals are fantastic.
My what, sir?
You know, for Joyo pedals, they're fantastic.
Yeah.
Like,
it's amazing.
Like for a sort of a relatively budget company.
Yeah.
Everything they seem to put out, it punches miles
above
what you expected.
All those distortion sounds that I have, even on the records, we just run it through that because we just
really?
Yeah, we generate the cabinet and we add the amount of drive that we want. And live, I actually have a volume pedal that feeds in the amp sim to the signal. So I can be playing a solo and then perhaps I've got a delay after it. So I can be playing a line and then I'll just bring in the distortion, and then that'll swell into a delay, and then you're off playing another phrase, and this kind of ethereal fuzzy goodness is there, you know.
I imagine that's really useful, being able to pull the drive in and out so organically.
That's another thing about the acoustic guitar rig. So, you know, and I'll apply that analogy to a wah pedal, for example. You know, if you're Jimi Hendrix or if you're Kirk Hammett or one of these infamous wah people. You know, you're in a band, you kick that wah on, it doesn't really matter that it's going right to the top end and it's really screechy and it's a noticeable tone change because you're playing with, you know, Lars Ulrich or whoever. When you're by yourself, it's all about shifting between sounds in a way that isn't jarring or off-putting to the audience.
I've never thought about that, but yeah, of course you're so right. Every new sound you create, you've got to... It has to have a consistency.
Yeah, one of the things that I... The amount of nerdery that we're talking about, I think, can be very well related to what I said about working within a very confined set of parameters, like an app. You know, it's like we're figuring out how to do the tiniest of tweaky details, which a lot of people would overlook. And it's the same in the playing with how you attack a note. You know, so many people overlook the attack of a note. Is it skin? Is it nail? Is it a mix? Is it, you know, is it, are you towards the bridge? Are you towards the neck? But anyway, going back to the bringing in of effects, absolutely. The wah thing that I was mentioning, when you bring a wah in, it's a noticeable tone change, but I'm using the ZVEX wah probe. And you can just leave it on the circuit all the time. And as you just walk up to it, it brings in the wah from a relatively neutral kind of pitch, right?
Yeah.
So it's not... So you bring in the wah sound. And actually on the live record, on Chosen Distancing, there's a cut of me doing, I think it's Superstition, Stevie Wonder at the Iridium from like 2015. And I do a little like solo and the wah comes in. But it's... I don't know. I'm just happy with the tone. You know what I mean? It's not kicking on a crybaby.
Yeah.
And that's the ZVEX wah probe, which I highly rate because it's
well, the probe is fantastic because of course it works in such a unique way because it works with a theremin style a proxy circuit. That's exactly rather than it being rather than you having to stamp it on with a crybaby, which puts you in a certain position as exactly. soon as you've stamped it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a wonderful thing about the Pro. I didn't realize you used a Pro. A massively underrated.
Massively underrated. It's not on my board right now, but that's because the songs that I used it on weren't in the last set. You know what I mean? I have limited board space, so between tours, I'll just kind of like put on the pedals that I'm going to use on that tour. Another one is like one tour I did, I had an additional volume pedal just with a mini Hall of Fame, which just had an all wet mega bright kind of plate reverb thing, and in order to emphasize certain strikes or hits, I just kick on and kick off this volume pedal, and it would kind of send it off into oblivion.
That's a great idea. And actually, the Hall of Fame Mini, kind of a really good choice that I feel TC made with
Brilliant
that.
Choice.
Like making a reverb pedal that literally just has essentially a mix control almost.
Exactly.
Like, you know,
amazing. And you can control the parameters, you know, when you plug it in.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks to Toneprint. Because, of course, the Hall of Fame 2 is a reverb pedal that's kind of always on your board. And you use the modulation preset on the Hall of Fame too.
Yeah. So, Joe, you have done your research, my friend. You're great. Let's have a beer one day. So the Hall of Fame has always been a staple because of the Toneprint functionality and how you can be changing and adapting the tones like every so often, and it stays. It's a fresh pedal. It's always exciting and it's always inspiring.
Do you have a Toneprint with TC?
I do. Yeah.
That?
So
awesome.
So basically, I was using the I do use the modulation setting for most of the songs, but then we had a show in Randers, Denmark, which is basically where they are, or near where they are, and I remember that day because Infinity War came out the same night. And me and Chris and the guitar tech and James, the lighting guy, we went to see it in Danish.
And that's how we define things now, is in Marvel movies, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, they're very important things in my life, to be honest. And, you know, seeing one of the most anticipated movies of all time in Danish was quite bizarre, if not for the price of admission.
Slightly, but...
we did a preset that is called The Old Hall. And it's basically a hybrid of the shimmer and the modulation stuff.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and then when you squeeze the little button, it goes super dark
the
and
mash
ghoulish.
Control.
Yeah. I have a song called The Old Room, which was on that tour in that set, and it's it has a moment towards the end where you want to be doing those swells, and it's a very ethereal piece that I was using the shimmer kind of circuit for, but now we use the old hall. So that's available on the Toneprint. It's not a store, is it? It's just an app.
Yeah, it's just an app. Yeah, yeah. You can get that. Yeah,
sounds
absolutely.
Wicked on electric guitar as well. By the way, if you're into the ambient sort of Sigur Rós vibes, check out the old Hall Toneprint. It's a good one.
Yeah, they are. They're incredible. I have so much time for all the Toneprint stuff.
Yeah, they're great guys as well.
They are absolutely. Of course, I also have Toneprints on there. I don't think anyone's ever downloaded mine.
I'm going to download it after this. What's it called?
Well, mine's for the Shaker Vibrato. I'm afraid I am a massive vibrato fan.
Oh, right.
Sort of extreme vibrato fan. So I have one called Inky Vibe because believe it or not, the scale that you can go to on a vibrato is ridiculous. So when the standard vibrato has a very narrow kind of field of vibratoing, whereas TC and actually on the way that you build a Toneprint, as I'm sure you know, you've seen you can the 0 to 100% of every parameter is so much more than what they actually give you insight to on the standard pedals.
Oh, yeah.
So I was able to create these vibrato tones that are more synthesizer than vibrato, and just I was able to make it so everything goes completely out of tune, so you can adjust on the sense so that I was never actually hitting a full note, so it sounds horrible and awkward, and I'm very much into that. I'm
excellent.
A big sort of anti
so when you hold the button down, it goes extra crazy.
But just goes extreme, and absolutely there's no way that you can make it sound good. It will sound off with anything you do, and that was why I wanted to create. I was very, very happy with that. But anyway, you know, sorry, side tangent about how excited I I am about tone print. I'm really glad that you've got one that you can download. I mean, most listeners, I assume, will have a Hall of Fame too. It's a £100 pedal that sounds absolutely incredible. Without a doubt, the most affordable shimmer reverb that sounds fantastic that you can get. You know,
I mean, and also for the touring community, TC is really good because pretty much every guitar tech knows the pedals really well, and also they're compact and they're stereo.
Absolutely. This a compact stereo reverb. Yeah, fantastic. I'll take that every time.
That's my thing. Is like, how small is it, and is it stereo? Like, the tone can come later. Like, will it fit on my board? Like, is it going to push me into excess baggage territory? You know.
There you go. Yes, traveling light, I imagine, is important when you're touring with someone with 20 guitars or whatever.
it's crazy. He, like, on the Justin Hayward tours, he has so much gear, and I have one acoustic. The electric lives in Nashville, so that just turns up at the venue. And my backline is my suitcase, which is I bring my pedal board with me in my suitcase, wrapped in my clothes, and that's it. So my backline is just like, and the pedal board isn't even a pedal board. It's just like a plank of wood that's just painted black. It's just, yeah. I mean, Anderton's, I did a Captain Meats thing with Lee, and he was so, like, shocked by how shit it looked.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. I did it with my dad, you know what I mean? It's like proper grassroots stuff, you know, and,
it's
if
just
my dad's
a piece
listening,
of plywood
it's
with,
not bad, it is really good, but the whole point is, you know, to do, like, a tour with someone who's sold, like, 70 million records, and have him look over, and it's just like a bit of plywood. It's just funny, you know, and he loves it. You know, it's like, great.
It is just ply with Velcro on it, just a flat piece
plywood
of ply.
Covered in Velcro. That's it, man. And that being said, I am going to rebuild the board and get a... what's the name of the...
Have you thought
guy?
About a brand? What brand would you go to for
it was
pedal boards?
I messaged him. It was a guy, because I was talking to Justin Alder
Serpico.
And Ash? I think he made one for beer. And it's like they're super crazy stylish.
Schmitteray.
Yes.
Rabea's got several, so
that's the one. Yeah.
Schmitteray is the one. Yeah.
So we started talking.
Rabea is a fantastic.
We started talking, and then coronavirus happened. But yeah, that's because I'm planning on when I do go back on the road to work to bring multiple guitars, and that requires a few more bells and whistles that would take me into Schmitteray territory for sure.
Well, they are very expensive, the Schmitteray boards, but they are incredibly good.
You can give me a discount, can't you, Joe?
Of course, I know them well. But on sort of that note, you know, of you moving on to more guitars. Currently, when you tour with one, but you use a lot of tunings.
Which means
you have to switch between them live, which is, I think it's incredible, A, that you do that with one guitar, you know, B, with one set of strings, considering what you do. And we'll talk about the tunings and the strings, obviously. But I think...
This is so fun.
It's testament to the strings that you've chosen.
Absolutely. There's a lot of thought gone into it. Yeah.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the strings. You use 13s, right? But it's a very specific gauge.
Yeah, so there's two different things. So first of all, on record, I will get strings that are suitable for the tuning I'm in. So if I have a tune that has a, say the bottom string's tuned down to B, then I'll get a 59 for it. You know, if the top string's tuned down to D, it'll be a 13. If it's to E, it'll be a 12, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's pretty well calculated on the records. Now, live, obviously, I can't do that. And what I do is I have a dadgad set. So that would be from top to bottom, 13, 17, 24, 32, 42, 56. So you've basically got a set of lights on the A, D, and G strings and a set of mediums on the E and B strings.
Right.
And the reason that's the case is because I find that that's as in the middle of what I do as it can be, right? It's common ground. I have a lot of songs in dadgad, but standard tuning isn't a stretch. I go higher, so tuning up to standard tuning on a few strings, but then I tune lower for a lot of songs as well. So it works, and I've got into the habit of that being what's under the fingers. Now, with regards to being able to do a show with one guitar and lots of different tunings, If anyone's listening who is, you know, I presume you have a lot of listeners on this podcast. I presume some of them will be young musicians, maybe starting out and figuring out what to do. You know, having those limitations, again, going back to the app analogy, teaches you how to deal with crowd control and how to, like, do a show. You know, I grew up playing open mic nights in sort of Guildford at bars, and you've got to reach the guy who's drunk at the back of the room, you know?
So what you're saying is banter becomes as important or almost...
Yeah, for my show. So, you know, I'm talking at a million miles a minute because I've had a couple of coffees, so I must apologize if people can't understand me or if I'm talking for too long. Yeah, so my shows aren't just the music. The shows are also the humor and the banter and the crowd work that it happens in between the songs. And even in the middle of the songs. You know, on the live album on Shows and Distancing, out next week, there's moments where the crowd are instructed to all yell the word cheeseburgers in the middle of the song. You know what I mean? Just completely ridiculous things that one doesn't associate with acoustic music and that kind of culture. And a lot of the banter is included on the record as well. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to do that because that's what I love. Like, when I go and see a band, I love, like, I think Devin Townsend is a great example of the banter and the humor and the rapport that you can have with the audience that makes it just as thrilling, or it raises the level of entertainment and value for the live experience. And seeing as we're in this environment with no live shows, I wanted to make this record as live as possible. So there's a lot of, I'll start talking about Brexit in the middle of a song on this album. You know what I mean? Just things that one shouldn't do. But all of this helps with the transitions between the songs and things like that. And yeah, that was very much something which was taught to me through playing in bars and dealing with drunks and things like that. I'd recommend to anyone starting out, go and play in a bar and try and learn how to deal with hecklers. It's great.
And I guess you need all that time anyway to retune in between.
That's the thing. Yeah, you've got to have... Yeah. And so some songs, if it's a particularly emotional song or a song that means a lot to you, you can express that and it gives you time to talk about it, you know? And you can tell a story, tell a lead up. But also you have to have stuff prepared for the inevitable string break. You know, if you break a string, then guess what? You're stood up there and there's all these eyes on you and you've broken a string. And you don't have a guitar tech because it's a solo tour or a grassroots, you know, acoustic club thing. So you're there changing a string. What are you going to do? Well, you've got to have some stuff in the back of your mind just to talk about and things you can do. My friend Petteri Sariola, one of my best guitar mates and a fellow Kunst Guitars in Dorsey, absolute incredible guitar player, one of my favorites in the world ever. I saw him break a string at a show we did together in Germany, in Kunzi's hometown, actually, where he broke a string and he got the whole crowd to do a freestyle rap with him as he was changing the string. And it was electric, you know. Everyone was clapping and stomping their feet and he was saying, you know, like, it's going through the hole, everybody, it's going through the hole. And it's like, as he's doing it and then he's tuning up and then it hits the four beat, down comes the snare, here comes the one, and then he's into the next song, you know.
It is very cool when someone can do that.
Yeah, that's the stuff that I love about the acoustic scene, man. It's live. You know, it's what I miss so much in this pandemic. Like, anything can happen. It's not on tracks. You're not going to see a band play your songs that sound just like the album. And it's, you know, all these extra layers of vocals and synths in the background. It's all on a click track in the drummer's ear. If he's out of time, he's out of time. If he breaks a string, he breaks a string. But if he's good at his job, you'll have a good time and you'll go home kind of saying, hey, that was a cool experience. Very unique. Hopefully you bought a CD and job's a good one.
yeah. And I guess on the tuning front, do you find the fact that you pick lightly helps, because you down tune a lot for the gauge strings that you play?
Correct. So there are some songs that only really work with a big PA and that kind of OC3 addition to sort of, it sort of somehow stabilizes that really low stuff.
I see.
But yeah, so tuning, so I have a 56 on the bottom, and I have a few songs where I tune down to A, and that sucks.
Yeah, that's got to be tricky.
But you know, the Kuntz makes it work. Right. Like, seriously, well, it's easier on that guitar than others, and there's something about it. I mean, the other thing is, yeah, it's the picking. Obviously, you've got to pick lighter, and it's also how that particular string is built into the arrangement, you know.
Well, do you think the headstock makes it is helps exactly with that? Because on the Kuntz, it's completely straight, right? There's no angles on the strings at all.
Yeah, so that was intentional. That's a design by him, so the strings don't break at the nut, they just keep going straight until they reach the pole pieces, and that's part of the signature of his design, and that does help with these lower tunings a bit, you know. The bottom string that we were talking about, it doesn't travel very far. It's one of the first pole pieces it meets. There's not really a big break in tension on that one. But it's you know, if you say you play with the bottom string tuned to A, how much it goes sharp will dictate on how you're picking it and how you're attacking it. So you're not strumming. You're picking it as its own bass note, and you're applying your own pressure and things like that. So it's the arrangement is a big part of it. And that's also, by the way, a big part of how effective the OC3 will be at actually functioning is how you're actually picking the note. As anyone who's played with MIDI pickups will know,
you
will have to bear in mind potentially making adjustments to how you play.
To
an extent, for sure.
Took me the longest time to work that out, that it wasn't the pedal, you know, with octaves. It was that I was heavy-handed. I was like, well, this doesn't track at all. And it's like, it's not that it doesn't track, it's that I'm yamming the string. And, you know, it's of course, fluctuating in pitch.
And there's some unfortunate things that happen if you choose not to sort of compress the signal. Like, sometimes the octave will spit out a really high, strong, powerful note on a fretted note on, say, the second or third fret. But when you play open, it won't really do anything. Obviously, if you're even lower than the note, you don't want that to lose power. So that's when a little bit of compression and cut really helps. So I actually run all my pickups into a mixing desk first, and then each effects pedal kind of has its own circuit, and that's and its own channel. And that's something that I picked up from the aforementioned Petteri Sariola. He's come from the production background as much as the guitar playing background. And
so you don't use a separate compressor as such?
It's built into the Bose T1 mixer that I use.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So the octave pedal and the amp sim and all of that stuff have their own channels. And there's each channel has, you know, three band parametric EQ, three band EQ, compression, noise gate, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, I see. I understand. I would have, because compression tends to be such a fundamentally important element when it comes to the sort of style that you have. I would have expected you to be sort of
not have something so shit.
Yes, that is exactly what I was trying to say nicely. I would expect you to be representing someone like Origin Effects you know, like some incredible multi-band compressor on a Neve desk compressor. But
there's a couple of reasons for that, and one of them is that, you know, the music that I'm playing on these tours is so exposed and delicate that you don't want to apply too much compression to anything. The only compression that I have is it's so subtle, you know. And the second reason, of course, is, well, space on the board and extra stuff. But realistically, it's just if you find something that works, then you learn to play with that. And
Absolutely.
It becomes habit. But I certainly have experienced hearing bad compression from other artists before. But I think the secret is just to dial it down, you know, dial it back and keep it as raw as possible with the
acoustic. It's always about the blend with compression. It's always about blending.
Yeah, and every song's different, you know, as well. I mean, if you're hammering a big pop strummy song, you're gonna want a bit more. But if you're doing a fingerstyle 7-minute Celtic ballad, then, you know, perhaps ease off. I did a show in California. I've played this venue 3 times. It's somewhere in Northern California. I won't name it. But each time, I don't know if they had the same in-house guy, but each time there'd be some horrible, like, noise gate that he would just, like, put on my channel. So I remember I was playing this aforementioned 7-minute Celtic ballad, and it was just this pin drop moment, and I was stoked on the playing. I felt like I'd created a nice atmosphere, and I hold the penultimate chord before it resolves to the root. And just as that's being held,
oh no!
The noise gate kicks in, and this kind of staggered, gross thing, and yeah. So, lesson learnt. You know, less is more when it comes to that kind of processing, I suppose.
Well, speaking about Celtic music, you've written articles. I can't remember which magazine for, but you've written articles on Celtic music's influence on your playing style.
For sure. Well, yeah, I mean, the main thing, I mean, I guess, as I mentioned, my mum was really into that sort of stuff, so it was always around the house. But to be honest, when I was at university, I was more into seeing bands like Flogging Molly and like Dropkick Murphys and things like that. really, Tony McManus, his playing was a really big influence on me, and he's sort of the Celtic guitar player. So I transcribed a few of his tunes. Ironically, on YouTube, you could find it in the dregs of YouTube. I did an arrangement of one of his arrangements of a Charlie Mingus thing. That's not particularly Celtic, of course. And then, of course, there's John Renbourn and Robin Williamson and that kind of thing. I had the pleasure of being able to open for John Renbourn before he passed away. So it was sort of very much that, and you combine it with the West Country, which is where we are, Bristol, Bath, that kind of area. There's a lot of that kind of music in the area. So it kind of permeates the culture. We have Glastonbury Festival down the road, and there's that kind of folksy kind of scene around here, you know?
Of course, yeah.
If anyone's interested in Celtic guitar playing, please do check out Tony McManus. He is the undisputed king of Celtic fingerstyle guitar.
Absolutely. Bringing back to tuning very briefly, just because a question that I didn't manage to get in. Have you ever experimented? I ask a lot of people this. Have you ever experimented with new standard tuning?
I have not. No.
There you go.
Should I?
No. Well, you know, that's the tuning that I use. You would be the first person ever who's been like, "Oh yeah, new standard tuning." You know, whenever it comes up, so you know, don't worry. It's Robert Fripp from
Of course.
In my opinion, the most important band of all time. But
well,
it's his tuning,
and my girlfriend's
the tuning
opinion.
I use.
And my girlfriend's
there you
opinion.
Go.
You know what? We're really enjoying throughout lockdown. Robert Fripp and his wife.
Oh my
been
goodness!
Doing their little videos.
Their videos. Listener, if you haven't seen these, I don't think we've mentioned them on the podcast. You know, all of my band are big fans, and we've been sort of sharing these videos amongst ourselves every day. And it's so wonderfully, you know, they because he was releasing a track a week as well for the first 2 months,
wow.
I think, as well, just on YouTube. He just released them on YouTube.
But, I mean, it's so wholesome, isn't it?
It's just, you know, him dressed as a bee with his wife running around his garden in a bee outfit. And the guy he's 81.
Toya Wilcox, right?
Yeah, Toya Wilcox is his wife, yeah. But I think he's 81 now. He's completely mad and fantastic.
Absolute legend. That's wholesome. Yeah, my girlfriend's really into King Crimson I haven't. The tunings that I use kind of started with Dadgad and then evolved into variations, and then from there evolved into a few other weird tunings, one of which was just based on happenstance. I just changed the guitar strings and they just went like that.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderfully organic.
I've got like five tunes in that tuning now, and I'm super.
Have you named that tuning? Or
I haven't. I know other people
need
have
to name
used
it.
I know
you
other
need
people
to name
have,
it.
I know Michael Hedges used it just by coincidence. Well, you can name it. We can call it. Okay, we'll call it new standard tuning.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Wonderful. Well, someone actually did rename Robert Fripp's new standard tuning. It's also called guitar craft tuning.
Okay,
because there was a classical guitarist that was using it slightly before.
That's the thing. I mean, if you look deep enough, someone's done it. Everyone's done something, before more or less. But no, this for anyone interested in trying it, by the way, the tune that I kind of stumbled
across. Yes, what is the tuning?
Well,
I'm going to write it down. Hold
I
on.
Discovered it. Yeah, so I was changing the strings, and I thought I'd finished recording my second album, and then I changed the strings after the last session, and then these two extra songs just came out of me after I found this tuning, which made onto the record. But it's C sharp, G sharp, so you have the fifth in the bottom, and then it's D sharp E, so you've got a semitone in the middle between the D and G strings,
right?
And then okay. B E on the top. So yeah, you get these really, if you're playing in the key of C sharp minor or G sharp minor, you get these really cool little licks and runs between the you know, those strings in the middle that are a semitone apart. It's really cool. Yeah, I've got a bunch of tunes in that. Yeah, one's called Reverie, one's called The Old Room. In fact, yeah, that's the one with the TC Electronic Hall of Fame tuning, tone print, rather. Yeah, it's a cool one. I recommend people try it out. It makes you look at the guitar totally differently, for sure, because none of your shapes will work.
Well, this is it. This is something we've spoken about on the podcast before. The other three hosts are staunch 440.
I'm still 440, like, you know, but yeah, it's nice, man. It's just, I like having a fifth in the bottom because it gives me some kind of one finger power chord ability that just helps thicken things up, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'd say like 80% of my songs have a fifth in the bottom.
Yeah, that's super cool. You know, before, and because, you know, we will need to round this up shortly, but we haven't spoken yet about Tonewood.
Yes.
Which is
the best people and the best device in the world.
I think it's an absolutely fantastic device. So tell us about it for listeners who aren't aware of the Tonewood amp.
Okay, so this thing is called the Tonewood amp. It's not got any wood on it, and it's not really an amp. I'll start with that. Electric guitar players get all these toys and all this fun stuff to play with, but acoustic guitarists, I suppose, have often been left behind because all an acoustic guitar player really needs is just a nice sounding room. So they kind of started there. So it's a husband and wife, Ofer and Helene Webman, based out of Phoenix, Arizona. They came up with this concept of this effects processor, this really small, relatively small effects processor, about the size of like a MXR sort of 10-band EQ, a little bit smaller than that. It sticks to the back of your acoustic guitar via magnets, so it doesn't damage the guitar with tape or glue or anything like that. And then it takes the sound from your guitar's pickup, say a piezo pickup or whatever, and it vibrates the back of your guitar so that reverb comes out of your sound hole and into the ears of the listener, which sounds like wizards. And I think it is wizards, but I had to do an NDA, so no comment on the wizards. But not only is there reverb, there's three different types of reverb. There's also delay, chorus, you know, tremolo, wah-wah, overdrive, all these effects in this unit, but it all comes out organically through the guitar's sound hole. So the cool thing,
you can walk around your house playing.
Oh, yeah. So say you've got a room in your house that you love playing acoustic in, like your bathroom. You can take the bathroom anywhere you go. You can use the bathroom anywhere in your house, Joe. If you need to use the bathroom, you can do it anywhere now. And it's really honestly amazing. Like, I've done a lot of things online talking about this because it's really that life-changing. I mean, my whole second album was composed with it.
Wow.
And even now, like, I don't get inspired by playing the acoustic guitar unless I have the Tonewood on it, because it instantly puts you into a hall. It's amazing. I liken it to playing electric guitar without the guitar being plugged in. That's really the best analogy.
I imagine, do you feel that it enhanced the percussive nature of it a bit more? Because I can imagine, you know, not being able to do any of that, but I imagine that the percussive nature of playing acoustic guitar can be a little dead before you've got, reverb behind it.
To answer the question simply, but the thing that it really inspires me to do is to play less.
Yes, of course. You know, reverb always does.
Because suddenly the second instrument in your band is the ambience.
Right, absolutely.
And that's why these songs that I have, and on the live album that I have, they're all live, so I'm not using the Tonewood amp because I'm plugged into my pedal board because it's coming through the PA. You can do that with the Tonewood amp, by the way, but because I have four pickups, it's complicated.
Of course.
These songs are written with it. I have a song called Reverie that's on the live record, The Old Room. What am I talking about? Any song that was from the second record I composed with it. And it's just, I'm sort of a little emotional talking about it because it just changed everything. Like, it really did. I was not inspired by the acoustic guitar until I put that on. And because it's a magnetic thing, I can have one tone with amp and I can just put it in any of my guitars or on any of my guitars. Yeah. It's not like a built-in thing. It doesn't damage the construction of your prized guitar. You have to put a little magnetic X brace inside it.
Which comes with it.
Which comes with it. But you can just take it out again. It's not a big deal. So yeah, it's just cool. But you can experiment with it. So I did I think there's a video of me on YouTube with this musician, Jake Allen, a buddy of mine. And we were at an Airbnb, sort of working with Tone Wood Amps. So they put us in an Airbnb together in Nashville. And we had some beers and we ended up running my Tone Wood Amp from his guitar. And then his guitar from my Tone Wood Amp. So basically, every time he played a note, I would have his delay coming out of my sound hole. And every time I would play a chord, he'd have my reverb coming out of his sound. So, you know, there's a lot of creative potential there. But, you know, anyone that has an acoustic guitar, you need this in your life. And I say that wholeheartedly. And also, going back to my whole man in shed thing, if I see someone doing something cool and they're not a big, massive company, like, all the more power to them. Like, go support those guys, especially like now during the pandemic. They've created something that's changed the world. And when it came out, it won all the awards in the magazines, didn't it? It was like platinum award here, gold award there.
Absolutely. And it's, you're looking at, you know, listener, if you're not aware of Tone Wood Amp, then, you know, you're looking at just over £200 for the unit.
Yeah.
It's available worldwide.
In fact,
so, you know,
I probably shouldn't say this, but if you go on my website or Instagram, there's a link which is a little bit of a discount.
Oh, well, there you go. There you go, listener. Check it out. If you would, you know, like to get involved in Tone Wood Amp. You know, what they make is absolutely fantastic. You know, I myself have been a fan of something. This is right up my street because about a year ago, got hold of a Yamaha, one of their transacoustics.
Yes.
Which features a mechanical built-in reverb and chorus.
Yes. I wonder whose idea that was.
Exactly. Yes.
Man
yes.
In
I
a
wonder
shed.
If they. Well, exactly. Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm currently representing the big band.
I do not represent guitar nerds, and what I say is not representative.
No. I'm fine with that. Forget the Yamaha series. Go out and get yourself a Tone Wood Amp. It actually means you can play your own guitar. So,
well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, they're two completely different products. One of them, that is the guitar. But the thing I like about the Tone Wood Amp is that I have five acoustic guitars in this house, and right now I've got one Tone Wood Amp that's fully charged, fully loaded, and I can just stick it on any of them.
There you go. Yeah, that you know, makes all the difference, doesn't it? Rather than having to own sort of four or five of the Yamahas that would do that same thing.
Maybe you just want one guitar. I don't know, man. It, to each their own. But definitely, you know, if you're going to take one thing away from this. This Guitar Nerds podcast, it is buy my album. No, I'm joking. Check out Tone Wood Amp, really. Best people, best product.
Yes, yeah. Well, we are actually, that is about all the time we have for this week's episode of the Friday Special. So it's been absolutely wonderful having you on, Mike. Thank you very much for taking the time to chat with me.
Joe, it's been a pleasure. Great to meet you, and thanks for having me on. I wish everyone listening all the best.
Yeah, absolutely. And dear listener, of course, I thoroughly recommend, of course, you know, Mike Dawes' music, and you'll be aware that his record is coming out. But if by any chance you aren't, you know, go and check it out. And of course, you're doing this this live show very shortly after this is put out. What date was the live streaming show?
November the 1st, and it'll be around 9, I think it's 9 p.m. GMT, because we will be in GMT then. And yeah, just if you head to mikedawes.com, all the info's there, and I'll be using the Tone Wood Amp a bunch as well.
Yeah, fantastic. There you go. So you can, of course, catch more Guitar Nerds over on Patreon at patreon.com/guitar nerds, or you can join us on any of the major social platforms with @guitar nerds, and we'll be back next week with our regular episode on Wednesday and another Friday special on Friday. We'll catch you then for more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.